Hey, football fans, it's Patrick Peterson, former three-time All-Pro NFL cornerback, and now the new host of First and Pod, the podcast that breaks down every game, every week, with new episodes dropping every Monday and Friday mornings. Plus, I'll be highlighting key matchups for DBs around the league on Patrick's Corner. Be sure to subscribe to First and Pod on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
There really are some parallels in Mardi Gras because everywhere else in the world, it's just Tuesday, literally, like we always say on Mardi Gras. But here, you know, we're at the convention center, media center, and we got the Super Bowl going on. If you're going to work today and just have a normal day going, highs of 74 could be beautiful, really, throughout the entire Super Bowl week. No rain until Tuesday, well after the game. And we're talking about highs between 75 and 80. And sunshine all the way through Sunday. So literally Chamber of Commerce weather right now at 63 degrees. They sent out a fog alert last night, but I didn't see any fog on the way in. So if y'all did, you can text us at 504-260-1870. While this is the center of the world when it comes to sports and events happening, the country continues to function. The world continues to spin. And President Trump continues to, I guess, rattle Washington be a good way to put it. Andy Smith joins us now, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. How you doing, Andy?
I'm doing well. Glad to hear you got some good weather down there, and I think it's good to see that New Orleans is in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, well, we're not in the Super Bowl. We're hosting.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you're trying to be a smart guy, huh? That's all right. That's okay.
Well, you know, heads are spinning certainly in Washington right now, or around the world, too. Nobody quite knows which way to focus.
Yeah, let's talk about, I don't know where you want to begin, because I know where I want to begin. Let's start with executive orders and what President Trump is doing. And this goes back to a conversation you and I had years ago about executive orders, where Congress in a lot of ways has abdicated their duties. So it's like there's a vacuum, and President Trump's more than willing to fill that vacuum with executive orders. If that's accurate, maybe take off on that and explain.
It is. The problem is with legislation is the Congress can write the laws, but somebody has to administer them. And that's the executive branch under the president. And the president has leeway as to what to do and what not to do. You can think about this. If you got a speed limit on the road, and if you're driving 5 miles and over the speed limit, a police officer can pull you over. And they may or may not give you a ticket, depending on how nice you are to them or whatever. So there's some wiggle room there in the enforcement of laws. That's the same way in the laws that are passed by Congress. But over the last, I'd say, 50 or 60 years, Congress has expanded the scope of the government. You know, the scope of the government has expanded, I should say, both presidents and Congress. But the specificity of the laws has declined. And you've seen presidents pushing and pushing and pushing, because that's what the branches of government do. They push to expand the power and control that they've got against what Congress maybe wanted them to do. And I think it's most famous in the Obama administration, where they lost in the 2014 midterms to Republicans. And Obama says he's got a phone and a pen, and he's going to do what he wants. Created many things and went against laws in several areas. And then during the Trump administration, you saw the same sort of thing. The Biden administration certainly saw the same sort of thing, pushing back against doing what you wanted rather than what the law says. And Trump is continuing that. Congress they're complaining most about it, but they're the ones that are responsible, because they were not specific enough in the laws that they created in the first place.
So it's like Mad Magazine back in the day, spy counter spy, right? What happens next? And I guess it goes to party leadership, because if the Republicans in the Senate or the House were concerned with the power of their respective bodies more than the party, then they would maybe challenge the president, or the Democrats would either way, but they don't have enough people to do that. Accurate?
Well, the Democrats don't have enough to really make a big difference on their own. They're going to have to rely on some Republicans. And Republicans are saying, how did I get here? And a lot of them saying, we got here because of Donald Trump. So
and
we don't want
to
antagonize
too,
Trump.
Right? And how do I stay
Absolutely.
Here?
Absolutely. You got to keep this a nice gig. You want to keep it. But if you could get primaried, by Trump supporters, and that happened to many Republicans over the last cycles, and they lost their seats that way. So it's a matter of power, keeping your power, but the Congress has not, as a body, not as an institution, wanted to push back much against this this trend towards increased executive power, because they like it when it works in their party's favor, and they stamp their feet when it goes against them.
When it comes to division of powers, the powers and the power behind it, it would seem to me that Trump's in control right now, because he's got the Republicans in the House and Senate more fearful of him and more loyal to him, however you want to phrase it, than they are concerned about protecting the strength of their respective bodies, whether it's the Senate or the House. Accurate?
Yeah, I agree right now that the amorphous thing that we call political capital, Trump certainly got it now. People, it's actually in politics is everything. Appearances is more important than reality, and it appears now that Trump is the most powerful person in Washington, and Democrats are willing to go along with that.
I'll use the word shrewd here, because it seems like there was a vacuum, and Trump sensed it maybe now like he didn't in his first term. And, man, he's seizing it and running with it. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. He is in the virtual Treasure Chest Casino Power Seat as we broadcast live all week long here at the Morial Convention Center, the host committee's media center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. Back in a flash right now, time for traffic on WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, broadcasting live from Morial Convention Center, the host committee center, media center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. Andy Smith is in the virtual Treasure Chest Casino power seat now as we talk about the Trump administration trying to move its agenda through. Tell me what's going on with the FBI, because this did get my attention where, let's go into the influence of Elon Musk. And what's going on with the FBI confirmation hearings, Kash Patel, I think is the guy's name, and firing or at least sending out a questionnaire to FBI agents to see what their involvement was with investigation into the January 6th riots. Take it from there, Andy, if you will, please.
I think that's interesting to unpack that, because there's been a lot of concern about our intelligence services and our law enforcement services, not just during the Trump administration, but in prior administrations as well. And who controls them? Are they kind of rogue on their own at times? Are their investigations politically inspired? Trump certainly believes that he was investigated unfairly, and that the FBI was involved with that. And that is an executive branch agency that the president should have control over. So what he's doing is pushing as hard as he can to exert his control over the political direction of the IRS, both with his appointment of Kash Patel, who I think it's safe to say that members of the FBI don't want to see him as a director. They want to see one of their own guys in there. And it's a lot of pushback, because there are some things that would show Democratic fiddling, Democratic Party fiddling, or Biden administration fiddling with those investigations of Trump. So the thing that he's doing here that makes it look bad, though, is, in my mind, is, you know, you can fire people, but this loyalty test, sort of, so to speak, is, I think, a problematic aspect of this.
But let me just jump in before we run out of time, because at that time, those agents, and I'm concerned with the overall security effort in the country here. We got the Super Bowl gone and terrorism and all that kind of stuff. But you could be losing experienced agents here who, at that time, correct me if I'm wrong, they were just doing their job. And I know that that's a pejorative phrase, but they were just doing what they were told to do by the agency that was then run or headed by President Biden. So they were just doing their job. And this to me seems kind of unfair. Thoughts?
I think that that's fair to say, because it's, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Mm-hmm. But during the Trump administration, when he was ostensibly in charge of the FBI, they were certainly investigating him. And I think that's probably what he's going back to. But the You're right that there are a lot of things that the FBI ought to be doing, maybe instead of investigating their bosses, and we should have them focus on that. And maybe that's the whole point of all this, is just to try to reorganize what it is that the FBI is responsible for. But like every bureaucratic agency everywhere, the goal is to expand your scope and expand your budget. Right. And I think the FBI has said the best way to do that is cozy on up to the people in politics.
And I get that if it's the Department of, you know, Interior, whatever. But when it comes to the security of the nation, my concern is that if for whatever reason Trump law, you know, brings in new agents and they start investigating Kamala Harris, and for whatever reason Kamala Harris becomes president in 3 years, just pick a name, it doesn't matter who it is, and then she goes and purges all the agents, it seems like we're starting from scratch every 4 years, and I don't think that's in the best interest of the country, is it?
Kind of sounds like a third world country.
Yeah, it does, Andy. As a matter of fact, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, talking about the Trump administration. And I'm getting some texts here. Some people think that it's the best thing in the world that he's doing. Other people think it's not so good. We'll take a break, come back. We're broadcasting live here at the Convention Center, Host Committee's Media Center on Radio in the Radio Row in the Montreal Convention Center. It is powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and Soso. We'll come back and talk about name, image, and likeness and a prospective settlement possible in the House case. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. I have Tommy Tucker here at the New Orleans Convention Center with all the Super Bowl festivities going on. It'll be a beautiful day today, spring-like, really, through next Tuesday, and that's all you need to know. It was a fog alert issued last night, but I'm not hearing about a lot of it other than some people texting in some patches of it on the causeway. This whole name, image, and likeness thing will put some fog in your head. If you have a hard time understanding it, welcome to the party. Mark Conrad joins us now, Associate Professor of Law and Ethics at Fordham, author of The Business of Sports, Off the Field, In the Office, On the News. He's our guest in the Treasure Chest Casino virtual power seat. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Okay. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about Livy Dunn and the suit that she filed, and maybe take a step back first and talk about the House settlement, which has nothing to do with the House of Representatives, although it does involve Congress, right?
Well, actually, no. It involves a settlement for
NCAA and
right.
Right. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, it actually involves a lawsuit, a settlement of a lawsuit by an athlete called House representing many other athletes, and the settlement was agreed to by the lawyers for both sides. The question is going to be, will the settlement be approved? And that will be determined in April by the trial judge. The settlement involves some back pay for athletes, but it also involves a compensation scheme for present athletes going into the future that is capped at about $20 million per, up to $20 million per school. So, and that's been one of the centerpieces of the objections to that settlement, among other things. But most of the class of plaintiffs seem to have agreed and agreed onto the settlement. So I think it's a good bet that the judge is going to approve this settlement.
I tripped over myself with Congress before. What I was trying to say is, at what point does Congress get involved with any of this, or will they?
Well, that's a good question, because with the changes in Congress and the changes in administration, there's a possibility that Congress could vote a law that will give the NCAA some additional legal protections. Whether that will affect this case or not is a real question, but it will give the NCAA protection maybe against other lawsuits on antitrust law. And Senator Cruz is going to be the chair of the Senate committee dealing with that, and he's been sympathetic to some legislation going through, and that could be a change. So I think we have to watch Congress and see, and also watch the attitude of the president regarding this particular issue. So there is a possibility that for future cases, it could be limited by this potential law passed by Congress and signed by the president.
I hope this doesn't come as a severe shock to the audience, but sometimes politics and the judiciary can kind of overlap. When it comes to the partisanship here, basically the Republicans would be on the side of the NCAA, if you wanted to make it that simple, and the Democrats would be on the side of the players, almost like a union and a company kind of thing?
Yeah, on a 30,000-foot approach, I'd say that is generally more correct than not. But having said that, you know, a Republican-based Supreme Court ruled against the NCAA a few years ago, and Justice Kavanaugh in particular was very critical of its business operations. So I don't think the NCAA necessarily has all the support from Republicans, and many Republicans may feel that the NCAA doesn't deserve this kind of law. But more likely than not, I think that Republicans are going to be against the idea of college athletes being unionized as employees and getting a salary. I think that will be likely to change because the labor board is going to change in terms of its personnel, and many of the advocates on that end, which is not part of the case, but it's part of another kind of proceeding, will be gone. So I think that area is going to be, at least for the time being, going to be suppressed. In fact, attempts to unionize have been withdrawn in anticipation of rejection by the full National Labor Relations Board.
You know, if I had heard that phrase years ago, I might still be married and not be buying my house for the second time. From a 30,000-foot approach, that's somewhat accurate. I wish I knew that phrase then, Professor. So let me take a step back on all of this. And for people that have not been following this closely, because, man, it's very complicated stuff. Let me take a break here real quick, and then we'll pick it up. We come back. You can talk about the whole name, image, and likeness thing, and maybe we can zoom down to 20,000 feet and get an overview of how we got from there to here and what it means in the future as far as, because what we're talking about here is players that have already played getting compensated for their efforts and then moving forward what the landscape looks like. We're talking to Mark Conrad, Associate Professor of Law and Ethics at Fordham, author of The Business of Sports, Off the Field, In the Office, On the News. If you have any questions or comments, text them in to the Oquinard Jeweler Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. We're live from the Morial Convention Center at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. A quick break for traffic now on WWL. Quickly back to Mark Conrad, Associate Professor of Law and Ethics at Fordham, author of The Business of Sports, Off the Field, In the Office, On the News. Tommy Tucker on WWL, live from the Morial Convention Center at the Host Committee's Media Center on Radio Row, powered by Lambert, Zaney, Smith, and So-So. So, Professor, if you can, in the minutes that we have left, tell us how we got from there to here with this House settlement and what it means for, where is the dividing line where this settlement addresses players that have had their time, and then moving forward, does it have anything to do with name, image, and likeness?
It sort of evolved over time because the NCAA, you know, was very strict about any kind of compensation and considered student athletes as amateurs. But starting about 10 years ago, a number of lawsuits started chipping away at that. Not specifically opening up the door to NIL, but coming pretty close. And the NCAA, just one day after the Supreme Court ruling, simply said, you know, we are going to change the rules because of the fear of more lawsuits, number one. And number two, more and more states were passing laws allowing NIL, and the NCAA realized that they were in an untenable position. But the question is how you do it. The question is how you organize it. The question is how the schools control it. And that's really open right now. And, you know, any attempts to restrict that, you know, have been the subject of lawsuits. And the House case was just one of a number of lawsuits regarding NIL and how NIL is awarded. And the settlement pretty much said that it'll be considered as part of back compensation for students in some kind of a financial standard. And also it said that students more generally in the future could potentially get some kind of quote-unquote compensation. They'll call it salary, but it's more than NIL. But at this point, we really have almost an open market, and we don't know where this is going to go because it's just been, you know, the professionalization of college sports is upon us, and the last 2-3 years, you know, the events have been just swirling, and I can see lots of fans really confused. from the model that used to be. So really stay tuned. I think that the settlement will be approved, even though there are some reasonable objections to it. And then we will go from there, and there'll be even more questions, I think, coming up in the future.
Only 30 seconds left. Going forward, does the Commerce Clause have anything to do with this as far as congressional action?
Well, Congress certainly has the power, you know, to pass laws regulating college sports. Absolutely. They're engaged in interstate commerce. You know, they negotiate TV deals, you know, streaming deals, et cetera. They sell tickets. They travel. So there would be no constitutional problem in dealing with that. But the question is, what kind of law would be passed? And do you give the NCAA basically a get-out-of-jail card, meaning an antitrust exemption, prohibiting future cases?
Thank you.
Of that type.
Thank you, sir.